Jeffrey, thank you very much indeed. Let me say, first of all, what a tremendous pleasure it is to be here. This is my first visit to Riga, to Latvia. And it's especially an honor to be here under the joint auspices of the Stockholm School and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, both of which represent traditions with which I have a long association. I've worked with the FES on many occasions, and I have been deeply influenced in my life by some of the representatives of the Stockholm School. I visited Gunnar Myrdal in Stockholm in 1980, and he was at one point a faculty member at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, where I am now and have been for the last 30 years. A professor, so I feel like I'm very much in on that territory with which I have a very strong affinity. And I want to thank Jeffrey for his kind remarks, but scholarship requires me to offer a correction, which is that there is actually no evidence that my father ever made that remark about economics and astrology. It appears to have been made by a figure named Ezra Solomon, who had the unfortunate fate, which as many people have suffered, of having his better quotes attributed to better known people. I once had the experience, actually this was in, let's say, 2003, I went to visit my father on his 95th birthday, which was October 15th. And I had just offered a blurb for Globalization and Its Discontents by Joseph Stiglitz. And my father was lounging on his bed, as he often did at that age, but I noticed a copy of that book, the Penguin edition, lying on his bed. And I figured he hadn't looked at the back cover, so I turned it over to show him with great pride my blurb, and realized that the British publisher had shortened it to three words, read this book, and had also shortened my name in the inimitable English fashion to J.K. Galbraith. And my father looked at it, and he smiled from ear to ear, and he said, "That's just fine." And I was on my way down to a 60th birthday party for Joe Stiglitz just at that occasion. So he paused for a second and he said, "Tell Stiglitz that he should look forward to the day 35 years from now when he shall finally have achieved his mature voice." Anyway, that's the kind of thing I grew up with all the time. I'm conscious here that I am here to speak, and my qualifications to speak on the future of Europe are somewhat limited. I'm not a European. But I believe that the perspective that I've been privileged to share, particularly in recent months, has something useful to offer. I had the opportunity to work very closely in a very interesting way, although not physically in Athens most of the time, with the Minister of Finance of the Hellenic Republic, Yanis Varoufakis, for the period from the end of January when he took office until his resignation in early July. And so it's, I think, that experience which possibly is of most interest to you, and I thought I should devote my remarks largely to it. Let me begin, though, by giving you a précis of the situation, because this is a set of historical circumstances with a very specific background, which is needs to be clear, I think, in all of our minds. Nobody was arguing, nobody, I think, in their right mind would ever argue that the government of Alexis Tsipras came to power in a country with a history of good government. And in particular, in the period before the crisis hit in 2010, the Greek state, which had never really developed a modern public administration or a modern economic structure, was a dystopian model of corruption, greed, and debt. It was a state which should not have been admitted to the Eurozone by the criteria. That was a political decision taken for larger purposes. And once it was admitted, the opportunities were present, were taken advantage of by aggressive lenders and ambitious borrowers to eager contractors to load up on weapon systems, infrastructure projects, highways and metro systems, the Olympics, and the, to cover the debts of various parts of an inefficient and rather poorly functioning welfare structure with additional loans. So that when the government of George Papandreou was elected at the end of 2009, it became immediately clear that the state debt was far higher than had been represented, both by the Greek side and by its European counterparts. And of course, that was also the precise moment when, as a result of the global financial crisis and its particular effects on the peripheral states in Europe, you had a complete shutdown in the credit markets. And this was in part because of the vulnerability of particular borrowers, sovereign borrowers in Greece, but the commercial real estate market in Ireland, the residential real estate market in Spain and elsewhere, and partly because of a general move in the aftermath of a financial crisis which had its origins in the United States toward safe assets. Investors sold the weak ones in their portfolios in order to buy the stronger ones. And so interest rates went up in the weak countries and they went down as people fled into German bonds and British gilts and United States Treasury bonds and bills. This left the Greek state and the Greek banking system in a deeply exposed position, and something had to be done. Now, what do you do properly when faced with a bankrupt whose debt burden, acquired by whatever means, cannot be paid? And particularly when that bankrupt is a sovereign state whose continued functioning and survival depends upon it being able to continue to support its citizenry at some level of living standard. The answer to that question is that normally what you do is you renegotiate the debt and you record the losses. But for reasons that were in some cases great and in some cases small, that is not what Europe and the associated community of creditors chose to do in 2010. What they chose to do instead was to make an additional very large loan to the bankrupt entity in order to transfer the debts from the entities that had initiated them, that is to say largely the banks of France and Germany, and the Greek banks, some of which were subsidiaries of French banks, onto the taxpayers of the rest of Europe as a whole, to move those debts from the private to the public sector, avoiding the recording of losses on financial institutions that would otherwise have been required. There was strong pressure to do this from the government of the United States. This was something that our Treasury Secretary at the time, Timothy Geithner, wanted to see happen because of a worry about the exposure of American banks through credit default swaps to the risks of a credit event affecting the European banks. It was something that the president of the European Central Bank seems to have wanted, according to testimony that was given to the Greek Parliamentary Commission on the debt, for reasons of his own, perhaps related to his own close association with financial circles in Northern Europe, and particularly in France. And what the ECB did was to buy a certain amount of Greek debt through something called the Securities Market Program at a deep discount, 30%, I believe, hold it on the ECB books, which then the Greek government would be expected to service at full value. Had that debt remained in the private sector, it would have been written down in 2012. There was the involvement of the International Monetary Fund in this. And the International Monetary Fund got in over the reservations of its own staff and the objections of a number of its executive directors, including the Swiss, the Brazilians, the Chinese, the Australians, who argued that the program could not possibly turn out well, that the Greek debt did not meet the sustainability criteria, acknowledged the fact that it was a bankrupt state at that time. Why did the IMF do this? Two reasons. One, it had very little other business at the time, and so it was an entity which was losing relevance in the world economy. And it had an ambitious managing director, whose later record I think tells a lot about him, who wanted to become president of France. These were all reasons that had nothing to do with the future viability of the Greek state. The burden of bad debts therefore passed onto the taxpayers of Europe as a whole, including taxpayers in countries that were substantially less wealthy than Greece itself, a source of well-justified resentment in the 5 years that follow. The price of being placed in this position was, for the Greeks, to accept a memorandum of understanding, which imposed very drastic changes initially on the government of George Papandreou. A very deep austerity, which was in any case going to be inevitable, there's no question about that, and one can make an argument that the memorandum was less severe than what would have happened if there hadn't been one. If there hadn't been one, Greece would have been out of the euro right at that point. But also a number of specific policy measures that went along with the very radical fiscal adjustment. Cuts in the civil service, about 300,000 people lost their jobs. There were cuts in pensions at all levels. The average, I believe, was on the order of 44% to 49%, with some of the pensions going down as low as 350 euro a month. There was a practically complete deregulation of the labor market and reduction of the minimum wage, which was intended to bring about a policy of what was called internal devaluation in order to restore the competitiveness of the Greek economy. And there was a program of privatization of state assets, including airports and ports and other facilities, which was intended to bring revenue into the state, but also to bring about allegedly a better management of those assets. When you took the whole project together, the official projections, which I believe came from the IMF, argued that there would be a reduction of GDP on the order of 5%, and that there would be a recovery after a few years, and by 2013 or 14, Greece would be back to its pre-crisis level. The reality was much worse. The economy continued to slide over the five-year period, and by the end of 2014, was about 14% below, 25% below. What it was at the start of the crisis, with only allegations of recovery in place. That's to say, the government in place claimed that there was a recovery, but in fact, what was going on in Greece at that time in 2014 was that prices were falling more rapidly than nominal GDP. And that was a statistical artifact that gave you the impression of real GDP growth. It was a situation of debt deflation in which it was clear to the Greek citizenry that things were continuing to get worse. Why didn't it work? Well, one can argue about why it didn't work, whether this was a flaw in the austerity policy, a flaw in the way it was implemented, or something else. But what actually happened was a collapse of investment, a complete lack of confidence in the banking system, and a lack of the kind of deep reserves, such as the forests that Latvia has, that would enable Greece to find a way through and to buffer the effects of the austerity on its citizens. And there was, of course, in this situation, no way that the Greek government could develop a coherent long-term strategy that would permit it to begin a process of resuming economic growth. This was a situation, in fact, in which the political instability simply got deeper. The Papandreou government fell after making a brief effort to submit the austerity policies to a referendum. The successor government, Lucas Papademos, fell. And then finally, the government of Antonio Samaras came up at the end of 2014 against a constitutional hurdle, which it had to select a president, and if it couldn't do that, would it get a supermajority to do that in the Greek parliament, it had to call an election. So in that kind of political instability, the control over Greek policy passed entirely to the institutions, to the creditors, and it's arguable, at least, certainly the perspective from Athens, was that the goal of the creditors, as revealed by what they were doing, was not so much to promote a recovery in Greece as it was to try and secure as many assets as possible and as much repayment as possible before the system completely fell apart. It was a very unstable and disagreeable time, which in 2011 and 2012 looked as though it might end up with the rise of a Nazi party. Not a neo-Nazi party, but an actual Nazi party with all the symbols and paraphernalia and program of a Nazi party, Golden Dawn. But that didn't happen. What actually happened was something quite unexpected and remarkable, which was that a party that articulated a coherent, alternative, and progressive response to the crisis consolidated an increasing body of support from the Greek people behind a loose coalition of people who'd never held state power before. That is to say, political activists, trade union organizers, ecologists, and expatriate college professors. And this very unlikely group, who would be, one would, even someone of my political adventurousness would be somewhat hesitant to entrust with serious state responsibilities, came together behind a then 39-year-old political leader, Alexis Tsipras, and an economic program that was very strongly influenced by the work of someone who I had brought to Texas in 2013, Yanis Varoufakis. The interesting thing about this movement was that it was progressive. It was definitely a left movement. It was a coalition of the parties of the radical left. But it was also a pro-European movement. It was a movement that was entirely committed, irrevocably committed, to the advancement of the European project and to making what was a dysfunctional system work better. The specific, one specific document, which was not the party program, but gave a lot of, of the general atmosphere within which Syriza operated, was called the Modest Proposal, which was co-authored by Yanis, by a former British Labour MP named Stuart Holland, and eventually in a later version by myself. And it offered a series of concrete proposals for helping not just Greece, but a spectrum of countries that were affected by the crisis and were unable to emerge under the existing policies to be able to begin stabilize their economies and bring back an atmosphere of hope and of growth. And there were four proposals in that package, which were all carefully crafted to exist within the legal framework without requiring a federalism or some change in the treaties that we thought would be very unlikely to be adopted. One of them had to do with mutualization of debts up to the Maastricht limits for 60% of GDP, using the good offices of the European Central Bank, its capacity to issue bonds, in order to stabilize the finances of all countries that would find themselves and found themselves in a position of not having market access. A second had to do with getting a case-by-case mechanism for resolution of banks at the European level, so as not to have a toxic link, which exists certainly in Greece, between bankrupt banks and a bankrupt state. a situation which greatly, basically makes it impossible to have deep confidence in the security of your resources, which makes it impossible really to use the banking system for very much beyond transactions, balances, and the working capital of small and medium enterprises. Something which had very interesting implications, by the way, later on when we got to the crisis in the spring. The third element was an investment program, which could have been done through the European Investment Bank and European Investment Fund, which are very large and capable institutions, and which could have provided a degree of return to growth. And the fourth was a proposal to provide an element of solidarity support to the most vulnerable households directly, nutrition assistance, perhaps unemployment insurance, that could be financed through a European-wide mechanism. And the point of this was twofold. One, to stabilize the incomes of people who are really in desperate condition, and the other was to provide concrete evidence of the presence and the benefit of being European to people who were coming to doubt it. Well, that was the core of a European policy, which Syriza was willing to talk about, did talk about, had a really serious interest in, but no capacity to raise once it came into government. Once it came into government, the limits on what could be discussed were extraordinarily clearly defined. I flew with the Greek government on about the 12th of February from Athens to Brussels for the first round of these negotiations, and they were over the terms of the existing financial assistance program, the existing memorandum, or what we call the existing arrangement. We're trying to find legal terminology that would enable us to have a little more flexibility than the word contract would imply. There was a finance minister who liked the word contract, but we didn't like it very much. And they were basically leaving aside some questions about you could haggle over which what the appropriate rates and application of the value-added tax should be. There were four major questions which the Greek government wanted to see modifications of the arrangement before one got to the overarching question of what to do about the debt, which for reasons I could talk about was something that could be pushed off a bit into the future. The most important of these from the macro standpoint was the target for the primary surplus. Here, the memorandum had specified that Greece was supposed to get a primary surplus of 4.5%, which nobody believed was a reasonable target. That was, in some sense, even the Samaras government, which had agreed to it, not expecting to actually hit it. It was something that was done for cosmetic purposes. But for a government that expected and had a good chance of surviving from a parliamentary standpoint, this was not a reasonable thing to do because it set you up for a repeated failure to meet the targets, which then would complicate your negotiating position going forward. It was also in contradiction with the basic stance of the government, which was to attempt to legislate and govern with some honesty about what you were attempting to do. So the Greek government's position was that the primary surplus target should be cut to something close to zero, 1%, 0.5% for a while. You could fudge it later on. But that initially this should not be an unmeetable constraint. And it's worth noting that there was no effort here to go to deficits. This was to stay within the framework which would, by any Keynesian standard, would be considered fairly austere, fairly reasonable. It was just not to get to the point of going to unmeetable extremes in order to service debts that could probably not be serviced in any event. On labor markets, the government's position was that Greece should have the benefit of the same standards, the International Labor Organization standards, that apply elsewhere in Europe, and that should not be the subject of a radical experiment. I would call it an unethical experiment in radical deregulation of the labor market, which for reasons, certainly as economists, we believe would not work, but in any event was an imposition that had almost nothing to do with any direct likelihood of an economic payoff or payback. Privatization, it was interesting. The Greek government was a left-wing government. It was not ideologically in favor of privatization, but it also was not going to act in a way that placed it at odds with Europe on this question. So it accepted the necessity of privatizing a fair number of state assets. What it asked to do, though, was to maintain an equity participation, a minority share, so that in the event that the privatizations were successful, the government would get some benefit from it. And it asked for a stretching out over time so that the prices would not be unduly low. The previous program had failed to raise any significant funds for the government. And it asked for conditions on with respect to specific specific conditions and specific instances, one of them being, for example, asking for labor standards to be applied to the privatization of the Port of Piraeus, which was to a Chinese company, Costco, raising the very interesting phenomenon of a left-wing government in a capitalist country putting labor standards on a right-wing corporation from a communist country. So, in any event. And on pensions, the issue was whether you should have to cut 120 euro from people who were getting 350 euro a month. People, a large number of people, several hundreds of thousands, who were on the already in a state where they were arguably on the edge of destitution. There were other issues related to product markets, which the creditors advanced under the rubric of structural reforms. But those were also contestable. For example, how many pharmacies should chain European, North European chains be allowed to open pharmacies in Greece, matters which were basically lobbying issues rather than something for which there was a well-established economic rationale. Those were the kinds of things that were under negotiation, and the negotiations began really with the 20th of February and went on for about 4 months. What happened during those negotiations? Fundamentally, nothing happened. And it was very clear that the negotiations were not real negotiations. They were not real negotiations because the creditors made it very clear, and I have to credit, I have a lot of respect for the German finance minister. He was candid from the beginning, and he couldn't offer anything. There was no illusion about this. The object of the negotiations, which was to get some leeway on reasonable basis of reasonable argument about specific questions, was met with an inability on the part of the creditors to bend on any point. There was the position of the governments from Eastern Europe, which just was an ideological disagreement. They felt they were right about certain policy questions, and they weren't willing to accept that the conditions or the ideas of the Greeks should be considered on equal footing. In the south of Europe, and in Spain, Portugal, but also in Ireland, you had governments which had left-wing movements inspired by Syriza, allied with, that they didn't wish to encourage. They objected. That was basically their reason. France and Italy could carve out some leeway for themselves and have done so, but they were, while they were a bit sympathetic, especially the French, unwilling to throw their weight in a serious way behind the Greek case. And the Germans, of course, had this consolidating role, their own internal politics, and whatever else was going on. But in any event, Germany, of course, became the crucial partner and the key interlocutor of the Greek government, which was a very interesting and direct and, I think, professional exchange. I did go on the 8th of June with Yanis to see Wolfgang Schäuble, and we had an hour and a half conversation about these matters. But it was very clear that the problem that the creditors faced, and this also included the institutions, the IMF and the ECB for their own reasons, was not related to any appreciation or lack of it of what the conditions were in Greece. They understood that the memorandum wasn't good for Greece, but they also understood that for their own reasons they couldn't change it. It's a metaphor here, which I used in a piece about this time, which was that this is a hospital. It's a hospital, and in all hospitals that I'm aware of, at least in the modern world, there's a particular ward that's called an intensive care unit. And if you are really in trouble, you get wheeled into the ICU, and you get strapped onto all kinds of machines and all kinds of fluids are pumped into your body in order to stabilize you, to keep you from the Grim Reaper. But this was a hospital that lacked an ICU. This was a hospital where all the patients were kept on the ward, and if one was showing signs of having real trouble, which in this case was Greece, basically they were told, lectured about not being with the program and not responding as well as the others. And so it was a lack of recognition that countries in different conditions, and Greece was in a deeply structurally weak condition. It's not a poor country, but it was a country that was not structurally able to respond to the kind of medicine that was being offered, needed a different treatment, was in desperate condition, and it couldn't get that treatment from that hospital. Well, the process came to a climax, as we knew it would at the end of June. It came to a climax because the program expired. It came to a, so that you couldn't hope for a further infusion of funds because the Greek state was out of money, having depleted its reserve by having paid $3.5 billion of basically good faith debt payments during this period, and because the European Central Bank at that point was in a position to lower the boom by haircutting the collateral of Greek government bonds, and thereby destabilizing the banking system, which forced the imposition of capital controls. And Yiannis went home to his wife and said, "Honey, I shut the banks." The consequence of that, interestingly enough, was that we thought that imposition of capital controls would be politically traumatic. It was not. Turned out that the Greek public was pretty well prepared, and the 10 or days, 2 weeks of capital controls in Athens did not yield the kind of political upheaval that we saw. In fact, it stiffened the resolve of the Greek public. Alexis Tsipras called the referendum as an act of frustration, but also because he expected that the Greeks would vote yes, and this would give him a graceful way and politically viable way to surrender, basically, to back off of what had clearly been a accept our deal or leave the euro choice without appearing to do so. The Greek public, bless their hearts, bless their rather courageous, stolid people. I was very impressed with ordinary people in this period. Voted no, 61.5%. Voted to stick with its principles and to pay a price if it had to. Then the pressure was escalated on the government, which already had within it a substantial group of people around the prime minister who were prepared to concede the issue. And of course, we know that on the 13th of July, the government capitulated in full and essentially passed from being a sovereign state to being a colony. Which is, if you read the summit document, I'm not entirely sure it's in the final memorandum, but certainly in the summit document, it states that the Greek government cannot even introduce a legislative project for public comment, let alone to the parliament, without the prior agreement of the creditors. That is not an independent country. That is, I think the Vice Prime Minister of Slovakia called a protectorate, but it's a colony. What is the policy that the parliament is now enacting as we speak? 48 prior measures. Measures to speed up evictions, to speed up liquidations, measures to put state assets on the chopping block, on the auction block, as quickly as possible. It's fundamentally a policy of liquidation, a policy of the kind that Herbert Hoover disparaged his Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon for recommending in 1932. And it's likely to generate, once it trickles down, it comes down, percolates down to the level of of implementation to the magistrates and so forth, who will have to act on these laws, I would think a certain amount of passive resistance. It's a fundamental fact in jurisprudence that when a contract is offered under duress, under coercion, or as Alexis Tsipras said in the Greek parliament, with a knife to the throat, that's not a valid contract. That is not a true agreement. You can call it an agreement. The agreement can say, as it does, that Greece has asked support from its European partners to, and then there's a long list of things, promote growth, employment, investment, et cetera, confidence, that it's supposed to do. That doesn't make that true. fact, it has a ring of cynicism, which is really quite profound. And while the government is going to implement this, not having made any secret of its distaste, it's not at all incumbent upon the ordinary Greek people to accept it. And one has to expect a certain amount of passive resistance, I would imagine. And it could pass quite soon to the return to the kinds of confrontations that happened in 2012, 2013. And the difference being that the government is no longer a right-wing government that is prepared to rely on the police to basically fight off protesters. In fact, the government and the protesters are from exactly the same political milieu. So, have you finished with the Greek crisis for the moment? As you said, Werner, it's not on the headlines. But I wouldn't be entirely confident that this is going to stay off the headlines. I would think that there's a certain number of months of reprieve. People are tired. New taxes will bring in money, so the fiscal position may be okay for a little while. But that it will meet the targets, that there will be a satisfactory improvement in living conditions, or a revival of confidence or business activity, seems to me as an economist to be very, very unlikely. So we can see what happens and how long the patience of the creditors, who are in a position to continually review the performance of the Greek state, will hold out. They can pull the plug at any time that they choose. Okay, just with a very few minutes, having given you that summary, how has this experience changed things in Europe? I think there are a couple of things that I can point to in a very neutral tone. One is that it has introduced an element of intimidation into European politics. This is very clearly when Cyprus capitulated in July, what happened to Podemos in Spain? It went down in the polls. And what had been a possible political upheaval in Spain became not necessarily impossible, but considerably less likely. The intervention of European leaders in the Greek referendum and in the Greek elections was direct, explicit, highly amplified by the Greek media. It represented perhaps, I don't know if it's new, but certainly to an outside eye, a very strong level of direct intervention in the allegedly internal politics of a member state, and one which was very far from promoting a spirit of cooperation. And I think you can rule by intimidation, but I don't think you can rule indefinitely that way. It strikes me as very unlikely that that's going to be a successful strategy in the long run. And the second thing that seems to me to be worth thinking about is this question of the plan B. The plan B in the Greek case was something I know a lot about. In end of March, Yanis asked if I would write up a memorandum for a plan B with a small working group. Basically an academic study group exercise. It was mostly conducted outside of Greece, very distinct from the Greek government. We were very careful that nobody knew about it because we didn't want to blow up the finance ministry. We didn't want to blow up the Greek government. We didn't want to blow up the negotiations. But we did want to know and to be able to say, if we were called upon on the 30th of June, what has to be done now. We wanted to have a checklist that we could present to the government and say, okay, who's responsible for this, who's responsible for that, how are you going to make the payment system work, how are you going to ensure that you have insulin in the hospitals, this kind of thing. And that was a project that I worked on for about 6 weeks. As I say, done with complete discretion. Nobody knew about it, and we were being criticized heavily from the left. My friend Paul Krugman, I know beloved of Latvian economists, was publishing it. You know, why doesn't the Greeks have a plan B? And I'm sort of thinking, staring into the sky and saying, Paul, why didn't you send me an email and ask me if I knew anything about this? I couldn't tell you, but I could at least warn you off of specious criticisms. But in any event, that was the way in which we handled it. For the reason that the Greek government had made a prior, formal, irrevocable, and sincere commitment not to exit the euro, not to exit certainly Europe, right? And we were not using this as a threat, and we didn't want to be interpreted as using it as a threat. It would undermine our position internally and externally, or their position, I should say. Next time, in some other country, under similar conditions, this will not be the case. The next time, it seems to me pretty clear, the government that has to deal with an unacceptable set of conditions attached to a debt renegotiation will not come to the table and say, we're in all the way, and it's up to you to show good faith and be reasonable. Syriza tried that. Government's going to come and say, here's what we'd like to discuss, and here's our plan B, right over here. And which one do you want to talk about? That's how it's going to happen, it seems to me. The finance ministry will have a door next door to the minister. We'll say, Office of Plan B. Right? It will be there. And that's a significant change in the, let's say, the discussion inside the European community. Unfortunate change. A very unfortunate change, because planting ideas in people's heads has a way of leading toward the formation of political programs and actions eventually. And just to close, I pose a question. The European Union is not a country, but it is a very large political formation. And I'd like to ask you if you can think of a large political formation that survived the departure of even its smallest members. How long did the Soviet Union survive the departure of the Baltic states? How long did Yugoslavia survive the departure of Slovenia? And there's a third example. The third example is the United States of America in 1860. How long did the U.S. survive the departure of South Carolina? Right? The smallest entity, I think, at that time. In fact, so small that the last Unionist in Charleston, South Carolina in 1860 famously described it as too small for a republic and too large for an insane asylum. Yeah, it's a set of consequences that followed are certainly much to be avoided. Thanks very much.